It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get some ideas for fun Wisconsin travel destinations for the whole family this winter.
First, information from the Government Accountability Board shows Governor Scott Walker's gubernatorial campaign failed to report employer information for 6,000 donors. Current campaign finance law requires employer information for donors to be submitted to the GAB, but the campaign finance overhaul bill that passed in the state assembly last week would eliminate that requirement.
A number of other campaigns from both parties also received warnings from the Government Accountability Board. David Cannon is with us to talk about this gap in donor employment information and campaign finance in Wisconsin. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So what's the reasoning behind disclosure of who these donations come from?
Well, the idea is that for the donors who give more than $100, you have to list who your employer is, because if there's any perception of impropriety in terms of, let's say, for example, the state legislature, you know, passed a bill to help a mining company. Well, if you're an employee of that company, and you're giving lots and lots of money to legislators who are voting on that legislation, that's something that voters, you know, really have a right to know, because it's the kind of appearance of impropriety that I think is valuable information for voters to have. If you make a change in law, which is being proposed, to no longer have to list your employer, but just list your occupation, it would be much harder, indeed impossible, to trace that kind of connection then between a donation and something that happened with a specific piece of legislation.
And one of the big worries is that an employer could use their employees, in effect, as a pass-through to get rid of limits on donations directly to campaigns.
Well, right. That's another thing that has actually happened in the past. Is there was a case where exactly that happened. And if you no longer had to list your employer, it'd be impossible to track down that type of illegal activity as well.
Now, the Government Accountability Board follows up with campaigns or political committees that have more than 10% of their donor employer information missing under the current law. Governor Walker had a lot of them. He wasn't the only one, though. It sounds like it's fairly common that this information is omitted.
Well, it's common, but it's not like overwhelmingly common. So there are about, in 2014, 1,500 different committees had to file reports. There were 188 that had at least one donor missing, and there were 29 who had 10% or more missing. So that's 29 out of 1,500. So it happens, but it's not that common. The two biggest omissions were the Walker campaign, which came in with about 27% of their donors did not have the employer listed. Mary Burke was actually second, but she only had 2.6% of her donors missing. She was the second in terms of the largest number of people missing, but you know, less than a tenth the proportion that Scott Walker had. So while yes, there are quite a few committees who received these warning letters, 29 altogether, Scott Walker's campaign was clearly the one with both the largest number of people who are missing and the largest percentage as well.
The Accountability Board isn't assessing any kind of penalties. They say that Governor Walker's campaign and the other ones, for that matter, are providing good faith efforts to catch up this information.
That's right. So the Government Accountability Board could have issued fines here, but they decided that the 29 different committees that did receive the warning letters were having a good faith effort to try to get that information, and so they weren't going to issue any fines.
Talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, about a disclosure of a campaign donation, specifically of employer information for donors. Now, David, we're having this conversation in what's now November of 2015. The election in question happened in November of 2014, so it seems like useful information about an election doesn't come to light until well after the election in some cases.
Well, disclosure, there's some kind of disclosure that happens right away with every filing period. And so if someone will actually take the trouble to go to the GAB website, that is reported quarterly on the website in terms of who the contributors are. It's what doesn't get assessed and revealed in any systematic way are these reports that are actually done that come out much later. So you're right, for the voter who just is reading the headlines and seeing what's in the paper, they're not going to be able to get access to information until well after the election. But there is some information on campaign activity, both contributions and spending, that is available not quite in real time, but in a timely fashion before the election as well.
Let's get into this idea for changing the law. As you say, dropping the disclosure of who the employer is and requiring less disclosure, I think that it doubles the amount. $200 would be the minimum. The argument is, if you're disclosing the employer, there might be retaliation. So if my company, Rob's Widget Works, donates to a candidate, that candidate's opponents don't like that, they could boycott or threaten or harass me. Is that a valid argument, do you think? Is that a real concern?
Well, certainly we have seen voter-inspired boycotts of different corporations in the past for what have been seen to be unpopular political positions they've taken. I know in several states that had same-sex marriage on the ballot, there were statewide efforts to boycott corporations who had come out either in favor or opposed to same-sex marriage, depending on the perspective of the group that was organizing the boycott. So clearly, corporations are subject to that type of boycott based on their political positions. On the other hand, it seems to me that's part of the political process, that if a corporation goes out there and is donating to different campaigns and taking political positions, or if they're organizing their employees to make those donations, then they end up having to defend those positions. Now, where it could be seen as unfair, I think, would be if the business didn't make any effort, sort of collectively to raise money to give to a cause or to a candidate, but yet then a lot of their employees ended up giving money in that direction anyway, then I suppose you could say that that's unfair that they would be targeted by a boycott. But you'd have to think that if there wasn't a concerted effort to organize it, then it should be more evenly split between, a liberal cause and a conservative cause, or a Democrat and a Republican. It seems unlikely to me you'd get, say, 95% of all donations going to one direction for a given business unless it was a concerted effort to do so.
And we've been focusing on this employer disclosure. That's not the only part of campaign finance law that's being changed. Another one has to do with coordination between campaigns and outside issue groups in accordance with court rulings on this. What kind of changes are we looking at here?
Right. This, I think, is probably even a more significant change than the part on disclosing the employer. So here it would basically allow any kind of coordination between the express advocacy groups, the issue groups that are not saying vote for or vote against someone, but are advocating for different issues, and can raise unlimited amounts of money to do that, and then be able to coordinate with campaigns to spend that money on the campaign's behalf, running ads on behalf of a candidate. Previously, you couldn't have that kind of coordination between an issue group and a campaign. Now, to reflect the recent Supreme Court decision, this legislation would make that kind of coordination legal, and that's something that campaign reform advocates are very concerned about, because they say this will be a source now of pretty much unlimited money in state elections.
And this is something that it seemed like there used to be a bright line that candidates try to steer clear of. The last John Doe investigation was in large part about this issue of coordination.
Right.
Now that's going to be done if this change happens.
That's right. This will be an entirely different, uncharted territory that it's really hard to predict how this will play out. But it seems clear, if this law is changed in this way, that it will make it much easier to have larger amounts of unregulated money influencing elections, because the line between these issue groups and groups that are expressly advocating for a candidate is pretty fuzzy. Like, you can be watching an ad and it seems like it's an ad in favor of one candidate or opposed to a candidate, but it's really an issue ad. If you just don't say the magic words of vote for, vote against, basically it's an issue ad. And so for the average voter watching an ad, you really can't tell the difference between those types of ads. And so what it means is that we will have huge amounts of unregulated money being in elections now because of this ability to coordinate now between the issue groups and campaigns.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison, with us to talk about the news that Governor Walker's campaign for governor last year failed to send in required employer information for thousands of donors. Many of us look forward to crisp autumn days, the colored leaves, the pumpkins, oh, and all the candy. But Leslie Kagan reminds us that the season's days are numbered.
Right about now, you're probably enjoying all that autumn has to offer. You're pulling your cozy sweaters out of storage. Perhaps in a heck, life's too short to deny myself candy corn moment, you devour a few bags. But somewhere in the back of your mind, amidst all this crispy revelry, admit it, you're uneasy. You know what's coming. Winter. Remember last year's, that really depressing one that knocked even half-glass full people on their cheerful behinds? I freely admit that I'm not the most chipper person. Writers rarely are. In fact, most of us are generally skirting the edges of the kind of cliff that one normally sees on the covers of gothic romance novels. But thanks to years of mental health tinkering, I recognize the warning signs that pop up before I'm about to go around the proverbial bend. So when I began to experience flashbacks from Stephen King's The Shining last February, I suspected that I'd come down with a profound case of cabin fever, courtesy of Mother Nature. It always gets down to our mothers, doesn't it? My therapist's advice? Get out of the house. Socialize. ASAP. This is a bitter pill to swallow for one who has found that the best way to cope with winter is to hibernate January through May. Why should I leave my cave? God invented Peapods so my groceries could be delivered to my front door. 17,000 television channels provide me with semi-entertainment, and I know how to build a fire better than most Boy Scouts. But in the interest of not being found ranting and raving in the springtime with red drums scribbled across my living room walls, I headed toward my local coffee shop, where I hope that someone not too perky, really happy people give me migraines, would ask if they could share my table. I'd absorb the atmosphere, make chit-chat, quickly down a cup of hot cocoa, and leave the shop feeling that I'd been a good patient. After driving the 3 blocks to town, a feat similar to competing in the Iditarod, there I was, cozied up in the corner of the roastery, when a very, very elderly woman approached the empty seat at my table. I stifled a moan and steeled myself to be assaulted by some over-the-top grandchild beaming and bragging. But as the woman unwound her 5-foot-long scarf with her knobby fingers, much to my surprise and delight, she suddenly jerked it up like it was a noose and said out of the side of her mouth, "I was counting on dying before I had to go through another one of these crappy winters." I found myself smiling for the first time in months. Turns out that not only therapists know best, so do authors. Misery really does love company, eh, Stephen King?
Leslie Kagan is the author of several best-selling novels, including her most recent, The Resurrection of Tess Blessing. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Yes, winter is coming, but we're going to try to embrace it this time around. And joining us now to give us some ideas for fun winter travel destinations in our state is Stephanie Klett, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Although it's hard to talk winter because I'm talking to you from Algoma with gorgeous fall colors still everywhere. And looking out at Lake Michigan, I can't even picture it frozen at this point.
Well, let's talk attitude, because it is coming, even though it is in the 60s here too, Stephanie. That idea that, don't hibernate, to get out and enjoy Wisconsin. You're all for that, I'm guessing.
100%. And for me, for many years, I wasn't a winter person. And it really was when someone taught me about dressing appropriately for the weather, had me do cool things like snow tubing, because I wasn't raised a skier. I like to do it, but I'm no good. But, get out there and do some things that you love. You know, if you like to hike in the summer, dress properly. You like to hike in the winter, you know, and we have beautiful candlelight snowshoe walks and hikes and skiing, tiki torches, luminaries. So it's a whole different way to experience the beauty of Wisconsin in really a more peaceful way.
So we are certainly not the only state that gets cold temperatures and short days and a fair amount of snow in the winter, but there are some unique travel opportunities right here in Wisconsin. What are some of your favorites?
Well, there are a lot. And one that I would recommend in the North Woods, and so for people going, what, go north in the winter? Are you crazy? But really, man, go there because they do winter right. In fact, half the people up there are there because they're winter folks and they love it. They embrace it. So head to Minocqua, which is just a charming town, and they have Minocqua Winter Park. And it is the Midwest's premier Nordic center. It has 45 miles of groomed ski trails. It has 10 miles of ungroomed backcountry ski trails. Of course, in Minocqua, in that whole area from Oneida County, Vilas County, you're going to experience some of the best snowmobile trails in the world. And, you know, that's another unique opportunity. If you're not a snowmobiler, it's a great place to learn. Wisconsin has 25,000 miles of snowmobile trails. So I love to send people who aren't a big fan of winter to Minocqua because there's something about the winter park that is just, it's incredible. And if you're not a winter lover, I would be surprised if you went there and didn't have a great time.
Now, say we don't want motorized equipment or skis or anything. What's a great place for that that winter hike?
You know what? I would recommend just about any state park in Wisconsin. A lot of them do winter hikes. A lot of them do, they coordinate it when there's a full moon. So you hike in winter, and some people just have the boots on. Some people bring snowshoes. A lot of time they'll allow cross-country skiing as well. But they will have tiki torches out, and the luminaries this full moon. And it is the most awesome experience. So I know Rasha Cree State Park in Adams County does, or Adams Friendship, does a really great winter hike. Lake Caganza State Park in Stoughton does a really great one. They are all over. So if you pick up your free Wisconsin State Parks guide, it will let you know.
So one of the big winter destinations the last couple of years, Stephanie, have been the Apostle Island Sea Caves. Do we have any forecast about whether they might be open this winter?
Well, you know what? We sure hope they are because it brings in tens of thousands of visitors from across the world. And you never really know until winter gets here. And that's one of the exciting things about it is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? And with the advent of social media, it really has become so big. So after having it open the last 2 of 3 years, we're so excited, you know, for it to open again. And if you're listening to this and you have never made the venture to the Apostle Islands to see these exquisite caves when they freeze over, it will stop you in your tracks. It's like a pilgrimage. You have to hike about a mile over land and lake to get to this cave, there are several of them. And it's hard to even describe. You know, all you need to do is Google, you know, Ice Caves, Apostle Islands, and you're going to see some things that'll blow you out of the water, and it will make you so proud to be from Wisconsin. So take the pilgrimage, and please dress appropriately. I was there with kids crying, and a woman was wearing a skirt, and it was probably 10 below with the wind chill, and, and flat. So you've got to dress the part.
Here's one that I've heard, camping, you know, at state campgrounds, state park campsites, used to be just a, you know, Memorial Day to Labor Day thing. I hear more and more people are stretching out the camping season, even into the winter. That's not something I'm probably going to do, but is this actually happening?
It is happening, and it's happening at, privately owned parks, and it's happening at state parks. I actually have a couple brothers that do it. We have camping with horses, you know, we have camping in the winter. And I think these folks are crazy. I love winter, but I'm not camping in winter. But if you ever see the shots of people at a campground and they've got their tent up in the winter, it looks pretty awesome. And they will tell you that the kind of solitude and quiet that you experience with winter camping is unlike anything you will ever experience. So we've got some diehard winter campers. So I think you and I might need to do it together.
Well, it's all well and good to get out, get some fresh air, but sometimes you just want to stay indoors and look out the window at the beautiful Wisconsin winter. What about some indoor destinations, especially maybe for family fun?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, obviously, is Wisconsin Dells, because, you know, they're the water park capital of the world, but they have the largest indoor water park as well. And they even have water parks that you can get a suntan through foil tech roofs in the winter. So you don't need to go to spring, you know, if you want a spring break, you know, head to one of the water parks indoors in Wisconsin Dells. You can get that suntan. You can play laser tag. They have full service spas. You know, they have, it's something for families, it's for couples. So that is one place I would send you to. And also resorts like Blue Harbor Resort in Sheboygan, that's a really neat place to go to in winter because it's surrounded by great dining experiences. And we know that when people vacation, they want that awesome dining experience. They want great food. And so Blue Harbor has this beautiful location on Lake Michigan. So even when it's partially frozen over, it's such a gorgeous sight, beautiful sunsets. And then all around it, you can check out these great Italian restaurants. A lot of folks came up from Chicago and created their restaurant in the Sheboygan area. So it's kind of a real happening Chicago scene right in Sheboygan.
Well, I think everyone should do like the Snowy Owls and come and spend the winter in Wisconsin. Well, Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today. Stephanie Klett is the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We've been talking about winter Wisconsin travel destinations.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we get the latest on the firing of the doctor at the center of the Toma VA scandal.
First, the Republican presidential last week, hosted by CNBC, sparked the sharpest attacks on the media so far in the 2016 election cycle. The Republican National Committee suspended its relationship with NBC over that debate. Some of the questions from moderators got strong reactions from the candidates, like this response from Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media.
Here to talk about media bias in presidential debates is Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So let's start with your initial reaction after watching the CNBC debate. What did you take away from watching it Wednesday night?
Well, it's always a good applause line to blame the news media. Several candidates did so at one point or another. Donald Trump criticized a question he was asked. Ted Cruz criticized questions many people were asked. And when they do those sorts of things, they get a lot of applause. And so one thing I took away was when candidates don't have something else to say, they attack the news media. And that's a great way to get people on their side to applaud.
So there were complaints from the candidates and from their campaigns that ridiculous questions were being asked, like in this clip from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
We have $19 trillion in debt. We have people out of work. We have ISIS and Al-Qaeda attacking us. And we're talking about fantasy football?
So do you feel like the moderators were asking questions that covered the real important policy issues?
Yes and no. I think some of the questions were about very important issues related to, say, the debt ceiling, related to people's tax plans and whether they really added up or not, related to candidates' experience for the office. Those are all legitimate and good questions, I think, to ask in a presidential debate. The fantasy football one, I get why Governor Christie was criticizing that. On the one hand, it's a pretty big industry and lots of people are participating in it and spending their money. And if they're being cheated by these companies, that's worth knowing. And, you know, I understand why CNBC maybe wanted to ask the question, but probably not as important as some of the other issues that are facing the country in the coming years.
And the question was whether it should be a regulated industry.
Right, right. I think Governor Bush has mentioned on the campaign trail that he likes playing fantasy football and his team is doing well. And so he got a question about should it be regulated.
So Florida Senator Marco Rubio said the mainstream media is basically a super PAC for Hillary Clinton, which is a claim of liberal media bias. Do you find that convincing?
No. The mainstream news media have been pretty hard on Hillary Clinton. And you don't need to look too much farther than the news outlet that most conservatives who like to claim or make claims about media bias point to first, which is the New York Times. And the New York Times has been a place that the Clinton campaign has complained a lot about, as have many liberal PAC organizations and liberal activists have claimed that the New York Times has it in for Hillary Clinton, that they don't like her. And, you know, a lot of this can be boiled down to something that people who study the news media call the hostile media effect, which is the idea that individuals tend to interpret the news media as being against their team and for the other side. And so when people see news coverage, they tend to remember the more negative stuff about their candidate and tend not to remember the more negative stuff about the other candidates.
So let's try to compare apples to apples here. So Republican candidates are saying that in the debates they're being treated unfairly. They're also accusing the media of throwing softball questions at Democratic candidates during the Democratic debates. So how accurate do you think that claim is? How would you assess the treatment that the Republican candidates are getting versus the Democratic candidates?
Well, there are two different scenarios here. On the Democratic side, you have an obvious front runner, one competitor in Bernie Sanders, and a few people who really don't have much of a chance at all, and most of them have already dropped out of the race or never got into the race in the first place. And so the kinds of questions that are going to get asked in that debate are different than the kinds of questions that are going to get asked when there are 10 people on the stage trying to differentiate themselves from each other, even though they're all members of the same party and generally share the same views on a whole range of issues. And so moderators in a debate of 10 need to try to find ways to point out, here's what these people think, here's how they're different than each other, in ways that moderators in a debate of two or three don't have to do. And so the questions are going to be different. I think there have been easy questions for all of the candidates in some of the debates, and there have been questions that border on whether they were fair or not to almost all of the candidates so far in the debates.
So going back to that idea of debates with 10 people on the stage, 10 candidates, is it really humanly possible to moderate something like that well?
It's really difficult because politicians are strategic actors who want to make sure that they only say what they want to say in the things they say in their stump speech, for example, or they want to ignore the rules when it suits them, and they want the moderators to enforce the rules when it suits them. And so some candidates tried to jump in when they technically by the rules weren't allowed to in the last Republican debate, and other candidates who should have gotten the chance to follow up in a rebuttal didn't get the chance to in the debate when they should have been allowed to. And so it's really difficult to moderate those kinds of things unless you have a rule that says the moderator can shut off your microphone. And that's something that candidates won't agree to because they'll look silly if they keep talking and then the moderator cuts them off. And so in the kind of the new list of demands about how these debates should go from the GOP, they've asked questions about how are you going to moderate? How are you going to enforce time? Will there be a gong, a buzzer? What? What will you do to stop us from talking when our time is up? And how will you decide who gets to follow up? And these are things the Republican candidates are worried about going forward in the debates.
We're talking with Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, and we're examining claims of liberal bias in the mainstream media. So the GOP candidates have been very loud and insistent about the fact that they feel like they're being mistreated. They've severed their relationship with NBC.
Right.
They're talking about changing the schedule of debates. Do you think that media outlets are going to be afraid of being perceived as biased towards one political party and risk losing access to the candidates on the other side?
Most media outlets often live in fear of being labeled as being biased in one way or another. And so that's something that the members of the news media always think about. And one reason they think about it is that when people complain about bias, it turns out it's pretty effective. It can even affect how aggressive reporters are the next time around when they deal with candidates. And so there could be kind of far-reaching effects for these kinds of claims. And one of the reasons to do it is sort of like working the refs in a basketball game, right? You'll see Bo Ryan patrol the sidelines yelling the other team is in the lane for 3 seconds, and it's because he wants the referees to pay attention to that and maybe call it later. And that's the kind of thing candidates on both sides of the aisle want to do. They want to get the media thinking, are these questions too hard or too unfair or too imbalanced? And if so, maybe rein them in and make things easier for those candidates.
So there's certainly a large body of media outlets that are very clearly aligned to a more conservative Republican part of the political spectrum.
Sure.
But Republicans seem to be the ones that are saying more more vociferously that they are being discriminated against, or there's bias against them in the mainstream media. So what are they referring to when they talk about the mainstream media?
They're referring typically to network television, NBC, ABC, CBS. They're referring to major national newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post. They're referring to National Public Radio in their view. They're referring to, you know, broad outlets that don't have a niche audience like Fox News or MSNBC or The Daily Coast or the Drudge Report, or something like that.
We are talking with Mike Wagner. He is a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. But we're talking about the perceived media bias in presidential elections after Republican attacks on the media following the CNBC debate last week.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you think the media is biased toward Democrats or toward Republicans? What did you think of how Republican presidential candidates responded to moderators at the CNBC debate? Do you think the debates have been fair or not? How do you think debate moderators should moderate? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion about allegations of media bias in the presidential debates with Mike Wagner, journalism professor and media expert.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from these presidential debate moderators? Do you think that the questions CNBC moderators asked of Republican candidates last week were fair? Do you think the mainstream media is biased one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So the criticisms of the moderators in the last debate were immediate, right there in the debate. For instance, Texas Senator Ted Cruz criticized the questions moderators asked in this clip.
This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions, Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
So, Mike, did Senator Cruz have a point there? Were the moderators asking questions that really address the issues that are important to Republican or all voters, for that matter?
I think yes and no. I think, you know, reasonable people can conclude that asking Donald Trump if he's a comic book candidate might conclude that that question's kind of going too far. But asking Ben Carson if his tax plan adds up when independent analysis suggests that there are significant shortfalls, and asking Marco Rubio, a paper that endorsed you said you should resign, do you have a reaction to that? Those are reasonable things to ask candidates. And so, you know, it's noteworthy to note that Cruz gave that answer when he was asked a question about the debt ceiling, and then ran out of time and said, don't you want my answer? And the moderator said, you used your time for something else. And then they moved on.
So did moderators ask questions to purposely encourage infighting among the candidates, would you say?
I think that's part of some of these organizations' goals. And again, this goes back to the Republican field is so large that it's important for moderators of debates to help draw distinctions between the candidates so voters can figure out who it is they're going to vote for. The problem is that even in 3 hours of a debate, you're not going to ask everybody the same question, and so you really don't draw the distinctions. You say, here's the most controversial thing about you, talk about it, and then move on to the next person. The thing that's most controversial about you is totally different, but talk about that. And it's not a great way for voters to learn anything about these Republican candidates. You know, it's the most qualified field in terms of size and scope that the party has had in a long time, and it would be worth it if we could hear more from them about the issues.
Let's go to the phones, and Dorothy in Oshkosh is up first. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, and thank you to your guest, Mike Wagner, for your insights. I have been watching the debates, and one of my questions is, how are the moderators chosen? The reason I'm asking that is because, not to give away my bias or anything, but I think Rachel Maddow is an excellent interviewer. She has real skill in what questions to ask, but of course the other side is not going to invite her to be the moderator.
Right.
I just thought that the moderators at the Republican debate, I didn't even know who they were, and they certainly didn't seem very skilled, whereas the ones at the Democratic debate were very skilled. So in some ways, it was skewed, but let's look at what the sides are offering, and do they have skilled moderators on the Republican side? I don't
Thanks for that call, Dorothy.
Yeah, it's a great question. How are these folks chosen? So in the primaries, they're largely chosen by the network that's running the debate. So in presidential primaries, one network, you know, it's their home field, right? So CNN or CNBC, they're hosting it on their air, their channel. So they choose people from their station to moderate those debates. And the quality of that varies pretty widely. In the general election, the Commission on Presidential Debates goes through a larger process. There's usually a moderator. Sometimes there are more, but recently there's been really one moderator that's chosen for each debate, and that person kind of goes through the rules. And there are just two candidates, don't forget. So in the Democratic debate, one reason that the moderators were able to keep them on task is because Hillary Clinton didn't feel the need to go over time and go after people because she's way ahead, and Bernie Sanders, her closest competitor, didn't really attack her much either. And so there wasn't a need to corral them, whereas in the GOP debate, many folks are going after Donald Trump, others after Marco Rubio, others after Jeb Bush, others after Chris Christie. And so there's more for the moderators to do, but they really don't have a hammer in terms of consequences they can give.
So, Mike, as a journalism professor, what do you think is the role of debate moderators?
I think moderators should force candidates to defend their record and talk about why their ideas are likely to work given the structure of our government, which is to say, you know, a House and a Senate currently controlled by Republicans, likely to be controlled by Republicans after the election. So Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders should have to talk about how they would work with the other side. And the Republican candidate should have to talk about how they would work with their party, which has had some infighting, as we saw in the kind of the falter all over who's going to be Speaker of the House. And so I think part of it should be, how are you going to get things done? And part of it is defending the things that you've done in the past.
After the CNBC debate, the Republican campaigns were talking about what they want to see for a new debate format. Mm-hmm. What are some of the options that might be out there? And what will they agree to?
That's a great question. So with so many candidates, it's hard to come up with a format that's beyond a bunch of people on the stage getting a short amount of time to talk about incredibly complex issues for a couple of hours. And so until a few candidates drop out, or until they say, we're only going to bring in people with this level of support in the polls, or we're going to say, we'll do three debates, 1 hour each, and we'll put five people on the stage at a time, randomly selected. So they could do a bunch of different things, but, you know, getting all of these different campaigns to agree is a tough row to hoe, especially because the leaders don't want to spend their time with Jim Gilmore and people and Rand Paul who are at the bottom. They want to debate the people who are up at the top. And people like Lindsey Graham, who can't get on the stage, really want to get on the stage.
We're talking with Mike Wagner, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW. We're looking at the perceived media bias of the mainstream media in the recent GOP debates. Let's go back to the phones and Randy in Arborvitae. Hi, Randy.
Hi. You know, I really think that you can't help but find bias in any type of newscast, whether it's on TV or in print, not maybe so much in what they say, but how much they say, the amount of time given to the broadcast, the amount of ink given in print. And as far as these questions go, you know, some of them really are questions of substance. But then you get these silly questions about fantasy football. I think it's time these commentators or mediators start asking more questions and get those other ones completely off the table.
Thanks for that call, Randy. And actually, let's go right to Gabriel in Milwaukee next. Hi, Gabriel.
Hello. I just wanted to say that it seems to me that, there's evidently a contradiction in their argument, because on one hand, they're saying that the questions for the Democrats were very soft, but then they asked them a soft question, such as, talk about fantasy football, and they're complaining as well. So it seems to me like it was just a way of, like your guest said, I don't think that they really had much to say, so it was much easier to attack the media.
Thanks for that call, Gabriel. So, Mike, a couple perspectives there on the quality of the questions. Were they too hard? Were they too easy? Are the candidates ever going to be satisfied?
No, it's a tried and true strategy to complain to the news media about questions. And you know, the caller's quite right. You know, some candidates complain the questions were too unfair because they were too difficult or too controversial or too exploitative. And others said these were questions about unimportant issues that shouldn't be asked in a presidential campaign. And candidates always blame the news media and have done so increasingly over the past several decades. And it's one of the things that's contributed to an overall decline in trust for the news media more generally.
So in just the last couple seconds we have, do you think the next debate, which is scheduled for November 10th and hosted by Fox Business, will be any different?
Yeah, just down the road in Milwaukee. Well, that's a good question. So we might see some of the moderators even reference questions that were asked in the past and refer to them in ways that build up their own brand on Fox Business to talk about more substantive issues. I would imagine that Fox Business would spend more time on economic issues, regulation issues, and that sort of thing. So I would look for that in the next debate.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about claims of media bias in the latest presidential debate.